Welcome to Cross Border Tax Talks, where we discuss the latest trends in international taxation, from U.S. tax reform to the OECD's latest developments. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's U.S. International Tax Services Leader. You can follow me on Twitter at XBorderTax. This week, we're in our D.C. podcast studio, where I'm joined by PwC's International Tax Policy Leader and Washington National Tax Services Partner, Pat Brown. Pat, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be here.
You have now taken the lead as the with your third visit here to the podcast.
It's quite an honor.
Congratulations. Unfortunately, Pat, our international tax conference has been postponed due to the novel coronavirus. And in lieu of the conference, we wanted to take a quick trip around the globe to discuss some of those latest developments in international tax that we were planning to cover at the conference.
Right. Well, this will be a poor substitute for the conference, but we'll do our best.
We're going to try to cram 2 days worth of material here into about 30 or 35 minutes.
Got it.
Let's get going. So, Pat, let's start with U.S. tax reform and regulatory guidance. We have received a mountain of regulations at this point. Some proposed, some finalized, some reproposed, kind of a mixed bag. Treasury has had a Herculean effort to try to get a lot of these regs. And let's acknowledge what an impressive job
Absolutely. That
the government has done trying to address just dozens, hundreds, thousands of issues.
Yeah.
And what we've heard from some public statements from Treasury is that they plan to get all of the regulations, I think whatever that means, done by October. We'll get to, I've heard that there's an election in November that they are trying to get that stuff done before the election.
Right.
But can you give us a quick update on what's going on with the reg packages,
sure,
what you anticipate to happen before the election?
Yeah, so we have gotten a lot of guidance, several thousand pages worth of guidance. But there are big issues still either not yet addressed or addressed only in proposed regulations. So there's a lot that we're looking forward to still to really help fill in kind of what is the complete picture of the U.S. system post-TCJA. You know, your mention of the timing of October 1st is interesting for two reasons, one of which is October 1st, okay, they want to have tax reform-related regulations done. What does done mean? Does it mean out of Treasury and over to OIRA? Does it mean actually in the register? We don't know the answers to these questions. It's still a very ambitious deadline because they've got a lot still ahead of them to do. Your mention of the election is also interesting because, of course, there is precedent for when a new administration comes in of not the same party as the administration that's going out. So, you know, when President Trump came in, he replaced President Obama, Trump a Republican, Obama a Democrat. It's not at all unprecedented for the new administration to put a halt on guidance that is either at the register or, frankly, in some cases, has recently been released. So I think Treasury does feel under some pressure to get guidance out as quickly as they can, in as much advance of the election as they can. Now, obviously, we don't know how the election will come out. But that, I think, is partly their motivation here, although they obviously haven't said that. Mm-hmm. In terms of what we're looking for, I mean, I'll focus on TCJA guidance. So we know that the anti-hybrid regulations have cleared OIRA and are likely to come out very soon. So this is 245 Cap AE and 267 Cap A. 163J is a big package that there's a lot of interest in this. So this is the restrictions on the deductibility of interest expense. We understand there are going to be four pieces of guidance. There are final regulations. There are reproposed regulations. There will be a revenue procedure and a notice. I think the most interesting for most folks who will be listening to this podcast are probably going to be the reproposed regulations, mm-hmm, which is a fresh look at the application of 163J to non-U.S. companies, CFCs.
Right.
There have been some speculation that Treasury might turn that off completely. I think we now have the answer to that question. They will not turn it off completely. They will repropose the application of 163J to CFCs, so we'll have to wait and see for that, what that means. I think a few other areas to mention, FDII, foreign-derived intangible income, regulations under Section 250. When those proposed regs came out, there was a lot of focus on the documentation burden that was being put on taxpayers. We understand the Treasury is highly likely to dial back those documentation requirements. I think a recognition that they probably overshot the mark there. So that'll be something that taxpayers will be really interested in.
Yeah, and we have a whole podcast dedicated to that. And that, I think, has been very intriguing to see how that's developed. Specifically, just the relationship that our clients and taxpayers need to have with customers to be able to try to get the data. And I've had a number of conversations with respect to sales contracts changing so that they can get, you know, that so that they're required or to be able to get that type of information for the FDII regs.
Yeah, I have joked that, and certainly based on some of my past experience, when you have to go to your customers to ask for something, they're often happy to oblige, but it's usually not free.
Right. It's a business deal.
Right. And that's what companies are very concerned about. Right. So I think the other three big areas. One, the guilty high tax exception. We have proposed regs on that. That will be very, very closely watched by taxpayers. Will Treasury make those regulations more flexible? I think, you know, when the regulations came out in proposed form, there was clearly a recognition that some companies benefited, but many other companies felt like they didn't and are hoping for a more flexible approach. We will have to wait and see. Previously taxed earnings and profits. We understand Treasury is going to issue two tranches of guidance in this space, one of which is likely to be out, or they're aiming to have out by October 1st. The other one will likely not come out that soon. One is more focused on TCJA specific things. The other one is sort of more general kind of guidance on PTEP as an attribute, how it is affected by corporate transactions, et cetera. And then the last piece I would mention, of course, we just saw recently proposed FTC regs, foreign tax credit regs. That was a significant package, a lot of grist for the mill in that package. Treasury's gotten a lot of comments on those proposed regulations, and we expect those to be finalized as well. So that is going to be, there is a lot still to come at us, and the decisions that Treasury makes in those regulations will tell us a lot more about what taxpayers really have to deal with going forward.
Just reflecting on this experience, because somebody was reminding me, it's been over 2 years, right, since the statute came out,
right,
and or since TCJA was enacted, and waiting for these regulations. The OIRA involvement is obviously something that has been new to the process, and you know, as somebody not from the Beltway and still really trying to understand, and we spent a lot of time on the cross-border tax talks really learning about that process at Treasury and at the IRS. Any reflections that you have on that and some of the delays? Because it seems to be there's been very much inconsistency on, you know, when we get the report or the report out that something has either gone to OIRA and then when we actually see the regulations. Any reflections on that?
Well, so when the change in policy was announced to give OIRA a more formal role in the review of tax-related regulations, there's a lot of speculation about what did that mean? Would it give taxpayers an opportunity to essentially go to a different forum, you know, effectively another bite at the apple in terms of making comments? I think a lot of taxpayers have gone down that path, have reached out to OIRA. You know, I think what we have seen is OIRA is really not staffed with tax experts. They are staffed with career folks who are very, very interested in helping to get to the right answer. They're very focused on things like administrative burden. So that's the area where they have tended to have felt the most ability to weigh in in terms of, you know, do we really need? So the FDII documentation is a great example of that. That's an area where a conversation with OIRA is not one where they're outgunned by the technical tax experts at Treasury and therefore unable to really have a meaningful discussion. When you're talking about, do we really need this level of documentation? That's an area where they can weigh in. We have seen and we have heard rumors that taxpayers have approached the White House. Of course, OIRA is part of the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House. So they have approached the White House and tried to get changes, substantive changes to regulations by approaching OIRA. My sense is that has generally not succeeded on a substantive front. So what that has meant overall has been, in some cases, regulations get stuck at OIRA for a little while, presumably because there's back and forth between Treasury and OIRA. We don't really know. We don't have visibility into that, obviously. But, you know, have there been significant substantive changes? If you ask Treasury, the answer is emphatically no, you know, that OIRA really has not changed the substantive outcome. There may have been some changes at the margins that we are really not privy to, but I don't think it has made it. I don't think it has had a dramatic impact. So I think the question generally, has it changed things fundamentally, slowed things down a little bit, maybe given taxpayers an additional place to air grievances or talk about documentation or administrative burden. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, doesn't seem like the impact's been huge.
Yeah, it will be very interesting to go back to your earlier point with respect to trying to meet this October deadline. And given what we've seen from the prior administrative shift, whether that this extra layer or wrinkle, whatever you want to call it, will potentially delay things and potentially impact
right. You
know, those regulations and how certain that those will stay intact.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And of course, remember when the policy was put in place to have OIRA get a formal review process, I think it was supposed to be like 2 weeks that they were supposed to be, you know, so this was supposed to be a very expedited process that obviously hasn't panned out. It has in some cases, but in general, it's been a longer than 2 week process. That's not a criticism of OIRA. They've gotten massive reg packages to review, and tax is not their only job. You know, they have to look at a lot of other regulations other than just tax regulations.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and we obviously have that same job reviewing those regulations when they actually come out.
No, that's right.
It's certainly more than a couple weeks.
No, exactly. We can sympathize.
Yeah, we can definitely sympathize. All right. Well, let's turn to the presidential election. So we're recording this in early March. We're past Super Tuesday. Michael Bloomberg has come out of the election, the grand experiment of coming in on Super Tuesday. Day, which I was very fascinated with, apparently was a failure. But one of the obviously, so now it looks like Biden is the clear front runner, but Sanders is still very much in the discussion.
And not inclined to go away.
Inclined to go away, absolutely, and has a ton of infrastructure that he built from the prior cycle. What are some thoughts, predictions with respect to the future of our U.S. corporate tax system? And I mean, I don't know if we want, maybe we start with Biden and some of his proposals and could talk a little bit about Sanders as well.
Yeah. So, of course, as between Biden and Bernie Sanders, you know, Joe Biden is obviously the more moderate of the two in terms of more to the center than to the left. Nevertheless, you know, Joe Biden's campaign, I believe, has proposed taking the corporate tax rate up to 28%. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a pretty significant, obviously, change if that were to be enacted. I think that's a campaign talking point. I don't think that's likely to actually happen. Bernie has suggested taking the rate all the way to 35%. He has also, of course, had attracted a lot of interest. He and Elizabeth Warren have both proposed some wealth tax. That's obviously not a corporate provision, but has gotten a lot of attention. There's a lot of question about constitutionality of that. So that's gotten a lot of press. You know, I think in terms of stepping back and level setting around this, it's important to remember the TCJA. We're not on a stable platform right now. Right. The TCJA did not get a single Democratic vote in either House of Congress. Mm. That is a powerful talking point for the Democrats. Now, the reality is, you know, the tax reform bill had lots of ideas in it that were either close to, very similar to, borrowed in some significant respects from ideas that Democratic administrations had looked at, had been interested in. None of that matters. In the realm of politics, not a single Democratic vote in either House of Congress for the TCJA is going to make it an attractive target for people to say, these Republicans got it wrong, we need to fix this. The most obvious place to go is the corporate rate. People understand it.
Right.
Raise the corporate rate a little bit. There was an understanding, including in the Obama administration, that the pre-TCJA rate was way too high. 35% was way too high. I think Obama had proposed 28%, if I'm remembering correctly. So, you know, somewhere between 21 and, again, I think 28 is too high. My speculation is somewhere between 21 and 25 is where you're likely to have things if the Democrats have the opportunity to move on this. Mm-hmm. And obviously, for them to have the opportunity to move, they need to win the White House. They need to hold the House of Representatives, and they need to take the Senate. Now, they don't have to get to 60 votes, because they can use the same reconciliation process that the Republicans used to pass the TCJA.
I know how that works.
So, right. Yeah. Right. And so, you know, there will be an opportunity for them to do something. I think in terms of messaging around this, one of the things that's important for companies to emphasize is a cut in the corporate rate from 35% to 21%. That's a $1.4 trillion tax cut by itself over 10 years.
Roughly a trillion a point, right?
Well, not a trillion a point, 100 billion a point. 100 billion a point, right. 100 billion a point, yeah. So 100 billion a point over the 10-year period. So 14 points, 1.4 trillion. So that's obviously a significant cut. The net corporate cut in the TCJA was, I think, around 300 billion. That, don't quote me on that number, but I think it was around 300 billion. That means that there were a lot of base broadeners, as we all well know.
Oh, yes.
That were put into corporate tax reform beyond, obviously, we cut the rate, we broadened the base, significantly broadened the base. And so what that means is if the only thing that a Democratic administration does is raise the rate, if they raise the rate by 3 points, you're now revenue neutral compared to where you were prior to the TCJA. If they raise it up to 25%, you now look at the pre-TCJA world to the post 2.0 world, and you've raised tax on corporations, which generally I think economists would tell you, you know, that's not where you want to go to raise money as a general matter, because it obviously has impacts on production. So, I think the world that we're going to be in if a Democrat wins the White House is a world that's going to see some upward pressure on the rate. There will be some countervailing considerations, including what I just described, which is, well, if you take the rate up much more than a couple of points, you're effectively putting us in a worse situation as corporate America than we were before tax reform. And is that really where we want to be as a competitive economy going forward?
So one question that I have, Pat, is how sustainable is the Section 250 deduction? So first of all, we know there's a whole bunch of just levers that are automatically going to hit. We think about the hashtag save the DA on the 163J, on the EBITDA, just how the numbers, the percentages change for the foreign derived intangible income, for example, in the Section 250 deduction. So some of those are just naturally going to change. But one of the questions or concerns I have is that repealing the Section 250 deduction would do a couple things. Obviously, would eliminate the foreign derived intangible income, but effectively what it would do would be put us on a worldwide tax system, right?
Yeah.
Where all of the CFCs are going to be subject to tax, and instead of being subject to tax at 13.125, or 10.5%, depending how you factor in the FTCs, the foreign tax credits, that, you know, repealing the Section 250 deduction would effectively move us to a worldwide tax system. Is that something that should be keeping me up at night, Pat?
Well, I wouldn't say keeping you up at night. I wouldn't say there's any certainty in anything in this area. But, you know, if you look around the world, no major developed economy has anything remotely like a full worldwide system of current taxation on home country income and foreign earned income. Nobody has it. There's a reason for that. It's because companies, you know, need to be able to compete in foreign markets. And countries generally recognize that income earned outside of their borders, one, there's less of a pull to tax it. It is income in somebody else's market. But secondly, if you want your companies to compete and win in foreign markets, if you're imposing a disproportionate tax burden on them, it makes it harder for them to do that. That is messaging that it never hurts to re-deliver to members of Congress, so they understand that point. I don't think members of Congress are always as sensitive as companies are to what the competitive landscape is really like. And it is a fierce competitive landscape, to be sure. Deals are won or lost. Transactions are won or lost by not very large margins. Winning a big transaction can mean a lot of jobs in the United States. Production of goods, you know, provision of services for a big global contract, that's jobs in the U.S. That's the message to be delivered to members of Congress. And I think making that message about, if we have a tax system that is so fundamentally misaligned to the tax systems of the other major developed economies, we are at a competitive disadvantage. That will hurt jobs in the United States. That will hurt your constituents. That's the message to deliver. And I think it's a message that, you know, now history's not always a guide, but if history is any guide, it's generally been a fairly successful message that's been delivered. Yeah, I do have concerns that when you look at Section 250, it is, and I'm sure this is why you have concerns, it sticks out a little bit. You can say, well, just eliminate that deduction. It's very easy. Why don't I just take that away? And then I'll have a system that, you know, people can understand. It all makes sense. And I think it's explaining what the consequences of that would be in the real world that I think it's really incumbent upon companies to be taking the time and delivering that message.
Well, great points. All right. So let's move outside the U.S. now. Let's start with the EU and the Anti-Tax Avoidance Directive, ATAD 2.
Yes.
So all members of the EU had agreed to ATAD 1, so the Anti-Tax Avoidance Directive 1 and 2. And there are a number of jurisdictions within the EU where they have committed to the Anti-Tax Avoidance 2. And I think about, for example, the anti-hybrid rules.
Right.
They have CFC rules. We have interest limitation rules, a whole number of
right.
different provisions. But what is fascinating to me is that these member states of the EU, which have committed to adopt these rules by January 1st, 2020, it is March and we still don't have the rules from some of the largest countries, including Germany.
Yes.
So any
yes.
update on that? What can we be expecting?
Well, you know, I'd say we sort of have three buckets, right? You have countries that have simply not adopted this in their national legislation. And of course, you know, the EU puts these directives out. The directives are, if you will, binding on the member states, but they're binding by way of their national legislation being put in place. So they have to legislate in their home countries to make this stuff take effect. Some countries haven't done it yet. Other countries, I think the UK, well, of course, the UK is now obviously out of the EU,
right.
but some other countries have taken a thoughtful approach to looking at what the directive required and implementing it in their national legislation. And then there's a third group of countries, which is in some respects the most fascinating, that has basically just taken the language of the directive and dumped it into their national legislation without much thought at all. And that gives rise to a host of interpretation questions in terms of, well, what do these words mean in the context of our national legislation? These words may have meant other things in other provisions of our version of the Internal Revenue Code. What do they mean now? And so what we're left with is a great deal of uncertainty. Mm-hmm. A situation that I hope will kind of find itself getting clarified in the coming months. I have been struck, and I know you have as well, in conversations that I've had with colleagues about the potential breadth of these rules. And I think there has been so much else happening, regulations under the TCJA, developments at the OECD, that this has been a little bit under people's radar,
mm-hmm.
Anti-tax avoidance directive. Certainly, U.S. multinationals have not been paying a huge amount of attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you step back and you listen to our colleagues from other countries describing how their country has implemented it, how they expect to implement it, some of the fact patterns that are potentially implicated, it can keep you up at night,
mm-hmm.
Just in terms of, wow, if I check the box on an entity, do I now have a problem with a double deduction when economically there's not really a double deduction at all and never would have expected that outcome? Mm. I may or may not have a DCL, a dual consolidated loss issue right. under U.S. rules, but people are familiar with that and they know how to run the traps on that. Mm. The anti-tax avoidance directive stuff, people are just not as focused on it. So I do think it's an area that folks should be paying more attention to. Now, that's easy to say. There are only so many hours in the day. But I do think that it's a word to the wise to be thinking about structures that you have involving EU jurisdictions and asking these questions. What could implicate anti-tax avoidance directive legislation? And what should I be looking for? How to think about this? If I am impacted, what do I do? These are questions that really companies should be asking, and I think they are starting to. But again, we're all playing catch up to a certain extent, and I would put myself in that category because I wasn't closely following this,
mm-hmm.
distracted as I have been, as we all have been, by U.S. tax reform and other things.
Yeah, and I think one of the things just to remind listeners is that some of these jurisdictions will enact rules this year that are consistent with the Anti-Tax Avoidance Directive, and it is very possible that those will be effective as of January 1st this year.
Absolutely.
And so for our public companies out
Absolutely.
There thinking about what those financial statement implications are, and
yeah.
obviously it's hard to know how to apply law today that hasn't right. been written.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So I get a lot of questions. We're like, well, yeah. we don't know. And you
yeah.
can look at some of the other jurisdictions.
Right.
You can look at what the OECD guidance. But we
right.
know it's been a mixed bag in a number of these different
right.
areas.
And they haven't always followed the OECD guidance in what they have put forward. So, you know, we will just have to see as it unfolds. But it is definitely a watch this space item for companies.
Okay, yeah. Well, exactly. Like we've already moved on to BEPS 2.0. BEPS 1.0 hasn't even been enacted.
Right,
in every
right, right. Exactly.
Yet.
Exactly.
But before we move to BEPS 2.0, I want to talk about digital taxes.
Right.
So that's another one that obviously has been more focused on particular the technology, the tech sector, the technology industry. But what's going on in digital taxation? This is another, this is one for me that has been just challenging to keep up with. And, you know, I was panicked that I wasn't going to be able to buy any French wine for a while, or it was going to go very expensive.
Right.
But then I'm more of a red wine guy as opposed to a white wine guy.
Yeah.
Red
was dodge the bullet there.
Right? We're going to dodge the bullet there. But in all seriousness, what's going on with the digital tax and the potential trade war from the digital taxes?
I mean, I'm you're going to get tired of hearing me say unstable, but I think we're in an unstable environment around this. Of course, we know the headline grabbing stuff has been the French digital services tax, DST. And of course, that has been the enforcement of that has been suspended through to the end of the year, pending an outcome at the of the OECD process. So the U.S. and France have agreed to do that as a means of not having the U.S. go fully invoke, U.S. trade sanctions against the French as effectively as countermeasures. So that's been getting a lot of the attention. Italy, Spain, the Czech Republic, to mention three other EU members, either have enacted or are likely to enact their version of a digital sales or digital services tax. Turkey, which is one of the largest populations in Europe, obviously Turkey is in both Europe and Asia. I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying that Istanbul is technically the largest population city in Europe. So you have a lot of, you know, digital inputs into that economy,
sure,
even though it's not within the EU. And Turkey has indicated that they're going to move forward with the digital services tax. And then you have, frankly, a number of developing countries that are looking at this. And so, you know, the landscape is certainly one that is likely to continue to be very dynamic. I don't say that in a complimentary way. Mm-hmm. It's going to be unstable. It's going to be something that companies are going to have to be paying attention to. Much will depend, I think, at least in the short term, on how the OECD project moves forward. But, you know, there is a certain sense in which when countries discover that there's a potential for a new source of revenue, they're probably not that likely to forever turn their backs on it. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a reality to the notion that, you know, companies are going to have to start dealing with a landscape where, in addition to a corporate income tax and in addition to a value-added tax, you're going to have to, in many countries, ask yourself the questions, there's this other tax. Am I subject to it or not? If I am, what does it mean? Am I able to pass it on? Or does the economic burden of it fall on me? You know, there is not a, unlike VATs, which by and large have a fairly standardized design, these taxes really run the gamut, these
right.
digital services taxes, all manner of them. Some of them are, you know, explicitly digital, some are not. And so this is a landscape that companies are going to have to navigate. Of course, this has been the OECD's messaging. We can be the savior here. You won't have to deal with any of this if we can just get agreement at the OECD inclusive framework. We will see.
Right. I'm with you. I think what will be really interesting to play out is we start talking about BEPS 2.0 and Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, that once some of these countries actually start to calculate the amount of revenue that they can generate, how likely are they to really walk
right.
away from that and really focus more on BEPS 2.0?
Yeah, yeah.
And does all of this just get simply layered on to each other?
Right, right. And that, you know, I mean, of course, the OECD has made a big part of its messaging that, you know, we can prevent this from happening. We will reach this international consensus and that this will be the path forward. You know, I do struggle a little bit to know to what extent that I know they're sincere
mm-hmm.
In saying that they really would like that to be the outcome. They think it's the right answer. I do question how long, even if we do achieve a consensus, how long that consensus can hold. But this is exactly what companies are wrestling with right now. How do I feel about the OECD project? What am I getting out of the OECD project? And if you're a digital company, I think the biggest thing you hope to get out of the OECD project is relief from proliferation of digital taxes. Mm-hmm. Maybe that happens. It's certainly something at least to hope for if the project moves forward. You know, for other companies, I think what they hope to get out of the OECD project is much greater certainty around mm-hmm. when you're doing business in a jurisdiction, how much tax do you owe? And that is, I think, an area where, again, we will have to see how well the OECD succeeds. So, you know, I heard recently a Treasury official said, you know, we're making progress on getting countries to agree to arbitration with respect to some aspects of what is within the OECD project. And, you know, getting agreement getting certainty on some aspects of your tax liability in a country is really not getting certainty at all.
Right.
And that's not lost on companies, right? So, you know, if a tax authority says, we'll agree not to audit you on this issue, but there's the other 17 issues we can still audit you on, well, I still have a problem in going and talking to my CFO. I don't know what my tax liability is. I can't have that certainty. Maybe I'm thrown into a, you know, very protracted competent authority process. So I think for companies, the benefit is relief from digital services taxes, big question mark around that. Certainty in terms of tax liability, big question mark around that. And so what you're left with is, I'm not sure how to think about this and how this is likely to proceed forward and what it will mean for me.
Sure. Well, so let's turn then to BEPS 2.0. But when I say that, I also want to acknowledge to one of our dear friends and colleagues, Will Morris, who I've had a number of discussions with, that he explains to me that BEPS 2.0 is a misnomer. And Will is very passionate about this really isn't about base erosion and profit shifting.
Right.
It's more about profit allocation.
Yes, it is.
As far as with pillar one.
Yes.
But I also remind Will that, like, hey, when people start calling something, it doesn't necessarily mean that that's really what it should be.
Right.
So I do want to acknowledge that. And I think it's a fair point.
Sure.
This is much bigger. BEPS 2.0 with pillar one and pillar two. And for those that aren't as familiar with that are listening, we have a whole podcast dedicated to to that topic. I would encourage people to listen if they're interested. But it is obviously on the forefront of corporate taxpayers around the globe. Any updates on that? And I mean, it seemed like there was a lot of momentum. Some of that seems to have frayed recently. And the U.S. involvement, you know, quick highlights on
sure. So, you know, I would say to cut to the chase, within the last couple of weeks, I think both folks within the U.S. and folks at OECD have used the term on life support to describe the OECD project. You know, it's not clear that may be a bit dramatic, but it's not clear to me that it is. It's very clear to your point that the project has entered a much more difficult phase. The challenge, of course, is getting countries to agree on how much profit should be reallocated, profit allocation exercise, how much profit should be reallocated to market jurisdictions, and under what principles. If you're going to take profit and put it in a jurisdiction, you have to take profit out of another jurisdiction. What jurisdiction is losing that tax base, and under what principle are they losing that tax base? These are really challenging questions to think through. I think the OECD feels a lot of time pressure to try and get to a result on this. And so as a result, they have tried not to dig too deeply into some of these thorny details around, well, what is the guiding principle here? The problem, of course, is in the absence of a well-articulated guiding principle, it's hard to know how to answer any of these questions. You're sort of left with, you're left feeling like the process is arbitrary. And I think that's what some countries are now feeling. And so they're arguing for more of an allocation of profits to market jurisdictions and different approaches to that in terms of, do I look at a company's global results? Do I look at a company's results by business line? Do I look at a company's results segmented geographically? What is the right lens through which to view this stuff? So these are all questions that that the OECD is struggling mightily to answer and to get consensus. I would say to folks, I think the phase we are in right now is a very dangerous one. For this reason, the OECD will very, very, very strongly want to achieve a solution, want to achieve success on this project. I mean, it's probably an overstatement to describe it as existential, but the OECD has staked an enormous amount of its institutional reputation on being the only body that can deliver a solution to what I will still call BEPS 2.0. The only body that can deliver a solution to preventing the proliferation of digital taxes around the world, to providing more certainty to taxpayers with respect to some of these issues. If the thing falls apart completely, again, genuinely believe that the world we will be entering into is a much less certain world, a world where economic growth is potentially threatened by a lot of unilateral measures, trade wars potentially. So why does that make the phase we're in now dangerous? Well, The OECD is a consensus organization. The way to achieve consensus is to keep throwing up ideas until you find a set of ideas that is able to achieve consensus. Very often that is at a level of generality that allows people, that allows countries to read into that consensus what they want. So it may be an illusion of consensus instead of an actual consensus that companies are actually going to be able to rely on. Again, for companies, it's all about certainty. Mm-hmm. And so we could have a, quote, success of this project, which is a set of principles that effectively ends up being like a Rorschach test that countries look at and see what they want to see and do what they were going to do anyway. That is a real concern.
I agree.
And so I think when I think about that, if I'm a company, it's absolutely about staying engaged. You know, if the last version of an OECD document gave you comfort, make sure that the next version of that document hasn't taken that away, because they will continue to put out documentation that will describe these things. And it is going to change between now and the end of the year in order for them to achieve, again, what they really desperately want to achieve, which is success on this. And the companies will not be sitting around the table in order to achieve that consensus. That's all countries. And so the way companies will have to, you know, satisfy themselves on this is by talking to national governments, et cetera, and trying to get their message heard. But it's going to be in an indirect way. So I think it's a dangerous time for companies. And I think it's a really important time to stay engaged.
So I think those are the general themes as we travel around the globe here. Just lots of uncertainty, and very similar to last year's International Tax Conference as well. And it's just amazing as I think about the last 12 months, how much has continued to change and evolve. And
I would agree, Doug. And I would also say that, you know, when tax is on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times in terms of just the OECD initiative, it has gotten so much press. CFOs are talking about it. CEOs are talking about it. The tax function is within a company is as relevant now, as important now as it ever has been. And so, you know, having tax directors in a position to be able to have conversations with their management about this is where this sits currently, this is where it might be headed, this is what it might mean for us, really important. Profile within a company, hey, that's pretty cool too, right?
Yeah, so great points. Yeah. Well, we'll have to leave it at that. So thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of Cross Border Tax Talks. Thank you, Pat Brown, PwC's International Tax Policy Leader, for joining me on Cross Border Tax Talks. I'm Doug McConey, PwC's International Tax Services Leader. Stay tuned in 2 weeks for another exciting edition of Cross Border Tax Talks.